I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. When Gregory Pardlow won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2015, his winning book of poems, Digest, had sold just 1,500 copies and had been rejected by mainstream publishers. His father said he didn't get poetry. It was like a game at a children's birthday party. That's what Pardlow writes about in his new memoir, Air Traffic. The title refers to his father's job as an air traffic controller and the strike that led to the destruction of their union when President Reagan fired 13,000 controllers in 1981, including Pardlow's father. Pardlow's dad was ambitious and demanding, competitive, a hard man to please, with a gift and passion for language. Gregory Pardlow describes growing up in Willingboro, New Jersey, his stint in the Marine Reserves, his struggles with alcohol, and his family being featured on the reality TV show Intervention. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about all of this and to talk about poetry as well. Gregory Pardlow, what a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. Your book is largely, but not exclusively, about your relationship with your father, but it's dedicated to your mother, Stretch. Where did she get the name Stretch?
My father gave her that name. It was because she was tall, and he was the only person I ever heard call her Stretch, and you know that was his pet name for her.
Your dad died a few years ago. Did he see this manuscript, or how much of this manuscript did he see?
No, he didn't see the manuscript at all. He knew that I had sold the book, and obviously he knew that I was working on the book because he and I had many conversations together over the last couple of years of his life. But even if the manuscript had been completed before he died, I doubt he would have taken the time to read it. He would have taken my word for it. Yeah, sure, it's great. Okay.
That tells us something about you and your father,
right?
Does it not?
Yeah.
You also write about your mother being the brains in the family. How so?
So my dad was the personality. He was the front man. But my mother was always quietly keeping it together. She was the one making sure that we got to our lesson. My brother and I got to our lessons, or obviously to school. She was the one fighting the fights and putting out the fires at home. So I wanted to make sure that readers understood that none of this would have been possible without her rock steady presence and determination.
I ran across a quote in another interview where you said a therapist asked you, when are you going to write an essay about your mother?
Yeah. So have I done it
yet? Have you done it yet? When's that one coming out?
I don't know. And it's funny. I had dinner with my mother the other night. And whenever she and I talk, there's this kind of looming question. Are we getting into that conversation yet? Or But at some point, it's going to require us sitting down, and we both know it. And she's probably not as reluctant to get into it as I am. But she's not entirely confident either, because who knows what can come up.
Well, I don't want to make too much of this, but at the same time, I do think, broadly speaking, with some exceptions, that firstborn sons, which you were, and namesake, which you are, that the relationship, even in the most functional families, the relationship between a father and son like that is both burdened and has responsibility and has specialness as well. I think moms are often taken for granted, kind of a given, as you said, took care of all the sort of logistics of family life. But fathers and sons, there is something so powerful there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also the case that because my father was such an outspoken and egotistical person, a kind of not that I'm an astrological thinker, but he was a typical Leo, right? He was very
interesting.
Yeah. And so I speculate, and I confidently speculate that he saw me as an extension of himself, as someone to be proud of, but as a product of his work. And so whenever I seem to be making an effort or striving to express myself on my own terms, I think he was threatened by that, and he would tend to you know, trying to put me back in my place.
Mm. Jealous, competitive. I mean, it felt like some
I think all of that. Yeah. Yeah. He wouldn't admit to either of those. But there's no other explanation for it.
And it seems that even you describe parties where he was a backyard barbecue and someone said something that I think was about a plane going overhead.
Right,
and he said, no, it's going south and not north. He had to be right.
He had to be right. He had to be respected. He wanted to be admired. He wanted his intelligence to be recognized. And so for all these things to take place, he had to be performing constantly. He had to be on stage. So it was tiring to have to feed that fire constantly. As his son and namesake, right, yeah.
As a reader, and this is always true with memoirs, how do you want us to view your father? Because there were times, I have to say, I was really angry at him. Because I felt like he was stealing your thunder.
Well, yeah. And I didn't want, when I started writing the book, the one thing I was sure of was that neither was I going to make him a kind of clear-cut hero. But I didn't want him to be, I didn't want to villainize him either. So I want readers to see a complicated man who, through it all, was nonetheless lovable and a dedicated and good friend. He has lots of friends from, people actually, as I go around with the book, I'm meeting more and more people who say, I knew your dad. Mm-hmm. He was such a great guy. What an amazing person. But beneath all of that, there's a reality. And I want readers to identify with or to understand and sympathize with the fact that there are deep human currents beneath all of us that are motivating the quirks and idiosyncrasies and both positive and negative that we all have.
What's so interesting, he went to Germantown High School here in Philadelphia. He was the head of the Black Student Union at the high school, apparently interviewed here at WHYY in the 1960s. And he gave a speech at a school board meeting. He was known for a man who could really use language in a really powerful way.
Extemporaneously.
Yeah, and without a script, right?
Yeah. He would never, and that was one of his mantras was, that I don't prepare. To prepare is to cheat somehow. And I could never think like that, and it presented a high level, a high bar for me to reach. And it was really intimidating for a long time. But yeah, he prided himself on his ability to show up and perform and dazzle.
And dazzle. And clearly there are some little snippets of things that he said, and they are dazzling.
Which I heard many times over the years growing up. So some of it is recreated, but many of the lines and images are verbatim.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section, and this gets you to second grade. You were having, as you describe, some behavioral problems. Your mom devised a really interesting way of trying to monitor your behavior. There was the good rock and the bad rock, and whichever rock you brought home.
It was one rock, actually. So I would either come home with the rock or I wouldn't come home with the rock.
And if you didn't come home with the rock,
that was a bad day.
That was a bad day.
There would be consequences, yes.
Well, let's read this section about your dad and his consequences.
My father devised punishments that were cunning and proud. He dropped the family dictionary like a Christmas ham on my rickety desk and gave me, with nothing more to go on than the mere attire of its pronunciation, an unfamiliar word. Disconsolate, for example. He would enunciate the word with the monotone of a spelling bee announcer. I had to find the definition of the word and then find, in that definition, another word I did not understand. I was then to look up that subsequent word and so on until I could prove to my father's satisfaction that I understood every word in the definition clearly, verifying the lexical descent from my original word, at which point he might or might not assign me a new word. The ordeal couldn't have lasted more than half an hour each time, but as I remember it, I spent entire evenings at my desk, heaving pages the size of car mats. As a result of this experience, for years to come, indeed in perpetuity, my father's vocabulary words continue to occur to me with a hint of irony, announcing their status in italics.
And the word perpetuity is in italics. That was one of his words.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine, as you describe as a second grader, that seems pretty onerous.
That's right, yeah.
But as a poet, did that help?
Absolutely. Kind of- so what I, it turned out to be fun for me because this was one of the few opportunities I had to engage with my father. And so I think over the years, the dictionary became a conduit to my dad's world, and kind of representative of his interior life. And so I have a fond relationship with the dictionary rather than the onerous one right. We would expect, yeah.
You grew up largely in Willingboro, New Jersey, across mm-hmm. the river from Philadelphia. You described it like a Monopoly board set. This is one of these planned communities by Leavitt.
Was it Abraham Leavitt and Sons, right.
Mm-hmm. They built it.
They built it, yeah. They built the Leavitt family built three full-scale towns. It was the Leavitt town on Long Island, the one in Pennsylvania, and the one that right. became Willingboro. It was the last one.
Like a Monopoly board. Right?
Like Monopoly board. So the way the town is set up, each park has its own character and cachet, attendant cachet that goes with it. And so depending on what park you lived in, which section of town you lived in, it immediately signaled where you were on the economic scale and what kind of family you might have come from.
You described the yellow line. I don't know if that was an actual yellow line or an invisible yellow line.
There was a line going. So the main street going through Twin Hills Park, where I lived, where I grew up, was a double yellow line. And so I use that as a metaphor for crossing, I say, between two hoods. The hoods being both geographic and metaphoric, manhood, childhood. Yeah, so it was
And all of that. We're almost up in a break here. Mm. I mean, how integrated or how segregated was this town when you lived there?
It did not occur to me at all that that there were any racial tensions. Not until I was older, when I got to high school. Of course, we become more politicized. But growing up, it was just this wonderfully integrated, ideal town. And I didn't even know it was how ideal it was. It just seemed... You know, it was such a bubble for me, and moving out of it and seeing the town change over the years was quite shocking.
Yeah. Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Gregory Pardlow is our guest. He won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for his book of poems called Digest just a couple of years ago, and he's got a new book. It's called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Gregory Pardlow is our guest. He's a poet, won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry a couple of years ago, and he's got a new book, a memoir called Air Traffic. You describe, as you said, this seems like you had, at least on the outside, a pretty nice childhood in that you could go explore Willingboro. You called these ramblings, which I thought was so kind of Tom Sawyer-ish or old-fashioned or something.
Well, I think I forget the name of the song, but it's a classic rock song. It's not going to come to me now that I'm trying to think of it, but that's where the term came from. And it wasn't quite Tom Sawyer-ish because we were out after curfew at 1 o'clock in the morning, roaming around the town, just exploring. Mm. Yeah.
But not doing like bad things.
We did nothing. No, we weren't. As I say in the book, the whole point was like it was like a game of tag. Just don't get caught.
And you mostly didn't.
And we mostly didn't. I didn't until my friends went out, and it was the one time that I chose not to go with them, and they did get caught because they did a little more than just rambling.
You describe reading Mad Magazine and comic books. Mm. I always. Mad Magazine just deserves so much credit.
So much more credit than it gets.
I know. I can't tell you how many people I know, maybe that struggled in school, and apparently you were having some struggles, but something about Mad Magazine.
Yeah, and this was a window into literacy, into reading. And I read every, my aunt and I had, well, my aunt had a subscription. And after she was done, she would pass the magazine on to me. And it was, I looked forward to it every issue. And in the back of the issue, you remember, was this illustration that could fold.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And I was always so fascinated with how these stories could come together. And I realized, obviously as an adult, thinking about my poetry, that concept plays into my sense of aesthetics and the kind of multiple stories that I want to create in my poems.
The idea of sort of how you can fold over an image and have it become something else.
Exactly.
So by using
what
words
you see,
that way?
Right? So there's the subtext and there's the surface text. What you read is the story, the straight story that you get. But then there is this entirely different story going on beneath the poem that you intuit. But I think of the reader. I imagine the reader kind of folding the poem over and seeing this
terrific.
Whole other. Yeah.
You were also on the Feingold diet for a while, and this was I remember hearing about that diet as a way to control ADHD.
It wasn't called ADHD then. They just said I was hyperactive. I was a hyperactive kid.
Do you think you were?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I still am.
Hyperactive kid?
Hyperactive kid, yeah. Little hamster running in the back of my head. But the Feingold diet was, I was not allowed to have anything with artificial flavors and colors or preservatives. And I don't know, I kind of put an ellipses behind that because I'm not sure if that was part of the plan to begin with. Because at some point, it seemed that at some point, I had to start paying attention to the word preservatives on the list of ingredients on the back of everything. And, you know, you look at anything, the list of ingredients, and you'll be hard pressed to find anything to eat that doesn't have artificial flavors, colors, and preservatives.
You also pretty much stuck to the diet, which is pretty impressive for a young boy.
Yeah. I don't know if it says something about my integrity or my naivete.
Would you have gotten in trouble if you'd gone off the diet?
It didn't occur to me to do it, so we never tested it. You know, my mother said, well, this is what we're going to do, and I just, okay, these are the rules, and I follow them very dutifully.
You describe at one point driving up to school and your mom is driving a Corvette. I thought, well, how cool is that?
My father.
To have a mom drive a Corvette.
Yeah. The Corvette was a family car. My father was into cars and flashy cars and everything flashy, period. But so we had a Corvette, but the Corvette was too expensive to drive up and down the turnpike to Newark every day. So he got a Chrysler, a fancy Chrysler New Yorker, to match the Corvette. So they were both silver with burgundy leather interior. And so my mother and I were relegated to driving the Corvette around town to go grocery shopping and drop me off at school.
That's great. Well, your dad was commuting to Newark because he worked as an air traffic controller at Newark Airport.
That's right.
This is a stressful job, as you describe. In fact, you write that most air traffic controllers at this time never made it to retirement because of the stress.
Yeah. So because of a number of reasons, as we can imagine, the personal reasons of alcoholism and, you know, substance abuse, the psychological damage of the pressure from the job. It's a difficult job to get into, and then a difficult job to stay in. And so the strike was really at asking to just acknowledge that difficulty on a very fundamental level. And if you're not in it, as we see from a lot of the response to the strike, the public at large just wasn't aware of how stressful, how damaging that the lifestyle of being an air traffic controller had been.
Was that, I mean, perhaps looking back on your childhood, did you see the stress on your own dad?
Yeah. I didn't know it then.
Right.
But in retrospect, I'm very aware that his short patience and his antisocial behavior. So he would come home and sort of either lock himself in his room, or he didn't want to talk. I attribute that very much to the stress of having to keep thousands of people safe all day long.
You include a letter that Ronald Reagan wrote to the head of PATCO here, saying to him, and this was October 20th, 1980, "You can rest assured that if I'm elected president, I'll take whatever steps are necessary to provide our air traffic controllers with the most modern equipment available and to adjust staff levels and work days so they are commensurate with achieving a maximum degree of public safety."
It's fascinating how that letter, how the demands of the strike mirror almost precisely what Ronald Reagan recognized before taking office, well, before the election even. So this was a campaign letter, promise of his. And they were asking just basically exactly what Reagan lists in that letter.
And he fired, this was 1981, so he became president and fired, what, 13,000?
Close to 13,000, yeah. So, but the number is, I've found differing numbers because some went back right away and, different circumstances,
You describe being a little boy on the picket line. I mean, it sounds like as you say, it didn't really keep anyone away from the airport, but nonetheless, there were these
protests.
There was
a symbolic picket line, right, which was along the highway. Whenever I drive on Routes 1 and 9 behind the airport, I try and figure out, was that where we were? Mm-hmm. Is that where we were? But what I remember very vividly were cars driving by, flipping us the bird, shouting, you know, "Go back to work, you lazy so-and-so." And people, somebody actually throwing food at us as they went by.
Uh-huh.
And it was just so confusing to me. Of course, on the inside, I was aware of how difficult and all the work was and how reasonable the demands were. But on the outside, the public perception was entirely different. Mm-hmm. And that took me a long time to understand and see what the particular failures of the strike were in that regard.
Your dad was one of the thousands that did not go
back
to work. So he basically, he lost his job. He was blackballed.
Job, pension, healthcare, everything.
Was gone.
Was gone overnight. Mm-hmm.
And this was, and Ronald Reagan, as I understand it, also said that all these PATCO workers could never work
in government again
as a reason, because of the, he was truly punishing them.
He was making a point. In 93, I believe, don't quote me on the date, but President Clinton lifted the ban.
Yeah.
But by then, you know, work conditions had changed. The equipment finally had changed according to the demands of the strike, ironically. And it was difficult at best for my father at that point to go back.
What was the effect of the strike? Or I guess not just the strike, but also being fired and never getting his job back. What effect on your dad?
Well, his ego, primarily.
Because he's a proud man.
He's a very proud man. He was a labor leader. He relished the spotlight. And in a way, he kind of backed himself into a corner because I don't think he would have gone back in any circumstances. But because he was so public about his involvement in the strike, symbolically, he could not possibly have gone back.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so his integrity was wrapped up in that. And more than the practical impact was obvious, right? Financially, we were destitute overnight, as I say. But the more long-term impact was to his sense of identity, his sense of his pride, his ability to provide for the family. Right, all of that stuff gets damaged, and it's like having a I don't know, a corrupt file in the in a computer program. You know, it's just it looks the same. It kind of operates the same, but he wasn't the same.
Manhood, right? I mean, that's part of your subtitle.
Right, and this is the manhood part of it, right? And then the impact on me, right, is it's trying to figure out, as a kid, I don't have the resources to see how the strike, you know, operates, how it undermines his sense of himself, and how it requires him to reinvent himself. So, you know, I saw this guy who was just he couldn't get a leg up. You know, the world just kept kicking him down, and you know, the story that I create in my head is, man, life's hard. You can't trust anybody. Don't invest in any long term plans and any companies or communities even. But as an adult, you know, looking back and trying to figure out for myself, trying to separate what my father was responsible for and what the world, the circumstances were responsible mm-hmm. for, I could see how his just character flaws and the positive parts of him as well contributed to the circumstances that kept him sort of falling down the rung every time he climbed up one.
He worked for SEPTA for a while. That's the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, which works mm-hmm. here in the Philadelphia area. Mm-hmm. New Jersey PATCO, he worked for them.
New Jersey Transit,
mm-hmm. rather. So it's interesting that he was an air traffic controller. So these are all travel, transportation jobs. Mm-hmm. Did he travel? Interested in travel?
No, he was not a traveling person. So the skills of the air traffic controller are so specific that it's hard to find, if not impossible, to find another job that, you know, you can transfer those skills to. So controlling trains was probably the closest thing he could think to do, and I think he had a number of friends who kind of went in that direction. Mm-hmm. But he was not a provincial kind of guy. Well, maybe he was. I don't know. But he certainly wasn't a worldly man. If he went on vacation to another country, he wanted that resort to be as much like America as possible. He didn't want to hear anyone speaking any different languages.
He's not alone in that. Just,
I know. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section, and I'm assuming you're sort of paraphrasing what he told you about flying. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. I want to have you read it, and I want to talk about it.
Sure. So my father's describing for me what it was like to control the planes, to work as an air traffic controller in the tower. "Think of each plane as an idea that pops into your head," he said. "They're all important ideas, but some aren't as pressing as others. Regardless, you have to keep them all in mind. You can have more than a dozen ideas in mind at one time, and you have to make sure they stay distinct. Let's say Teddy Pendergrass might be one idea, for example. Or funnel cake, aluminum siding, potholes, the Dagobah system, Bimini. And that would only be 6 aircrafts. We're keeping it real simple. Somehow, you have to keep them all located in your mind while you're handing some off, exchanging their information with the other controllers. All your delicate ideas have to remain perfectly clear and distinct in your mind at all times."
And he goes on to say, or you go on to say, he says, "What makes it tricky," my father said, "is that some of your ideas, you can sense them, but they haven't really occurred to you yet. You don't have words for them." And reading this, I felt like, well, that is poetry, isn't
right.
it?
Right.
I mean, that's how you talked right. about Mad Magazine, but that's what poetry is, keeping right. all these mm-hmm. planes in the
and
air.
And you would think that I would recognize the metaphor very very quickly, but sometimes sometimes the most obvious things are difficult to see. Right. But yeah, that's exactly what's going on.
But that is when he explained it to you, that those were pretty much the words he used.
Absolutely. In fact, I got the list. He gave me that list. You know, these are things that come into that he thinks about funnel cake, the Dagobah system, Bimini.
all of that sort of embedded in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you say that your father, I mean, I think of the dictionary and just the way he loved and used language, that that sort of set the groundwork for you to be a poet?
I don't know if it set the ground. Well, certainly the dictionary punishment, as we were talking about earlier, that set a firm foundation. I do want to say, going back to another thing that we talked about, my mother read to me poetry as a small, very small kid. We read Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verses. I didn't even remember it until years later. I was doing an interview, and someone asked me about the poetry I read as a kid, and I said, I didn't really read any poetry as a kid. And I thought, well, for some reason, Robert Louis Stevenson is coming to mind. I don't know why. So after the interview, I called my mother, and she said, we read that book every night for months, if not years, for a long time. And then she started to recite the poems that we read together, and I remembered them. I could hear them, in her voice. So anyway, I don't get all caught up there.
No, that's fascinating. But, I mean, fascinating that you did, but you didn't remember.
It, right? And so what I am certain of is the logic of the poems or the illogic of the poems, rather, right? The power of the image. That was very deep in my psyche.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Gregory Pardlow is our guest. He won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for a book that came out just a couple of years ago called Digest. And we've been talking largely about his new book. It's called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. And again, to join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and just to recap here, poet Gregory Pardlow's father was an air traffic controller. He was fired by Ronald Reagan during the strike of 1981. That experience not only shaped the rest of his father's life, but his own life, and I should say our guest's life as well. Pardlow writes about his complicated relationship with his dad in his new book. It's called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. And you can text us actually to join our conversation as well, and it's at WHYY Radio Times. We talked a bit about being in second grade and having some learning issues. What kind of a student did you end up being?
I considered myself a smart kid. I was always in the advanced reading group, the advanced math groups in my classes. But when I got to to junior high, I guess I was distracted by girls and, you know, the things that happen. And then in high school, it was cooler to play sports, and so I pursued other things. And not having any models. No one in my family at that point had gone to college, and I didn't have a narrative. I didn't see myself doing that, right? And most of my friends' families, the path was you graduate from high school and you get a job, and at some point you get married, yada yada. And so we know this story well. So I wasn't motivated to be an excellent student because I didn't see a payoff for it. When I did get into college, when I graduated, after high school, I was accepted to a number of schools, but I chose Rutgers University Livingston campus because that's where my friends were going.
Sure.
And that was a bad decision on a number of levels.
Because the friends were there?
Because the friends were there, right. And we all kind of washed out together within a very short time. But I don't think, you know, it's not an uncommon thing to do. And not having a community otherwise, you know, I probably would have had to seen the same fate anyway.
But it's interesting. You joined the Marine Reserves to get money to go back to school, I guess, or to get money to live on, rather than getting a job, if you know what I mean. Something about the Marine Reserves.
Well, I was, I don't know. You know, we talk about the subconscious impulses. And to my mind, it was just a matter of, I had a friend who had gone off to join the Marine Corps, and he was home doing recruiting duty. And he had asked me, and invited a bunch of people who were back home that spring semester, to come in and just sit in the seat. You don't have to say anything, just listen to the recruiter, and it'll be a big help to me because I, you know, this is my job. So I said, sure. I showed up, and the recruiter promised me the world. And I said, well, of course. Yeah, that seems easy enough. And it was the Marine Corps Reserves. And I had no idea what the difference between the Marine Corps or the Army or the Air Force or, you know, were. So I wasn't intimidated at all, very naively.
So you got there, you got to Paris Island.
After I signed the papers, after I agreed, I started doing some research, and I was like, what on earth did I get myself into? But at that point, you know, I think, and this is something I certainly picked up from my father, I had committed, and I'm not going to back down now, you know.
Well, you lasted 2 years.
I lasted 2 years, yeah. And that was... I'm still trying to figure out why, because I actually enjoyed, in retrospect, not at the time, but I enjoyed being a Marine and being in the Marine Corps, the accomplishment I felt. And, you know, we talked about my being a hyperactive kid and what would today be called ADHD. In the absence of drugs, you know, Ritalin drugs to combat the ADHD, the Marine Corps gave me the discipline to sit in the seat and focus and get whatever job in front of me done that needed to get done. I don't think it's an overstatement to say I wouldn't be a writer if I hadn't been in the Marine Corps.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, no, obviously no excuses, right?
No, exactly. It's just right. And I mean, you think about the... What's the payoff for writing a poem? You know, I still do, obviously, spend months sometimes writing a poem. For what? I mean, it's so the practice is, it's pure discipline, it's pure focus, right? And it's not driven by any carrot. So, or, you know, idealistically, it's not driven by a carrot, but yeah, so the Marine Corps served me well in many regards, and I think I was too confused as a kid to figure out how, again, you know, looking for a narrative, how does this fit into some acceptable, socially approved story of how life should go.
You did spend some time working at your grandfather's bar, and then you write, money, power, and geography had not worked out for me. Language had given me a semblance of escape.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's even the music, and as I say, being at the club, which he...
This is in New Jersey, right?
This is in Pensauken, New Jersey. It's not there anymore.
Serengeti?
The Serengeti Cafe and Jazz Club. It was on the Circle in Merchantville. We had the club for 10 years, and I would see these musicians, you know, coming in and playing for $50 a night, and they were incredibly talented and accomplished musicians, and you know that too just did not fit in with how I saw the world, understood the world to work, and they gave me permission to see a life to see a payoff, a reward in doing what I enjoy doing, and not just pursuing something that everyone would agree I'm supposed to do.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your book about being a poet.
Absolutely. I am a poet. Poetry and civic duty share a porous border in my mind. Being a poet doesn't make me virtuous. Poetry never prevented me from totaling a car. No shrink wrote me a prescription for poetry. Poetry never represented me in court. Poems can't keep me from getting mugged or roughed up by police. Poetry never cured a hangover, and it never paid a bar tab. Although I have wept and prayed to poetry to ease my burden in these and other regards, which have constituted at one time or another the core preoccupations of my daily life, poetry answers no prayers. Poetry is useless to me in all but one way. Reading it makes me a nicer person. Reading poetry has improved my ability to intuit and thereby negotiate more effectively the needs and desires of others. I'm no mind reader, but poetry puts me in tune with the unarticulated registers of language, a skill that, through reflection, also helps me identify my own blind spots. The best poems model the kind of work I want to do on myself. It's difficult to identify my strengths and flaws on my own, especially if I've spent my life around people who think, act, and perceive the world in the same way that I do. Especially in diverse, diversity-poor environments, poetry is the best supplement to help getting out of one's own head.
I really love that section because it's so practical in a way.
Yeah, it's kind of that Ben Franklin wisdom, that almanac wisdom that I'm looking for and trying to get at. Yeah,
but feeling that it makes you a better person.
You know, and these are, again, you know, having so much to do with permission. These are things that I would not have said 20 years ago, right? It's important to be a good person. What does that it sounds it sounds so obvious that it loses meaning. And I think part of what I'm interested in as a poet is finding the meaning again and the value behind the way we've made cliches and sort of slogans out of these terms. Mm. Yeah.
Let me read an email from Chris who says, my father was a PATCO controller and I was 10 at the time of the strike. He'd worked at Newark Tower, but he was in the TRACON radar station. Mm-hmm. Think of the John Cusack movie Pushing 10 at the time. I, too, remember walking the picket line as well as the many difficult years that followed. Thankfully for him, he was able to requalify as a controller during the Clinton years, able to retire doing the job that he sincerely loved.
Wow.
I mean, it's a different story from your father's.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I hear one of the great things this book has done is it's brought people together who have these shared histories, and you know, on the one hand, it's great to hear how people have recovered in various ways from the strike. But on the other hand, in a very selfish way, it also reminds me of how my father did not recover, the ways in which he failed to recover, and just highlights all the more how the kinds of personal challenges that he faced that made it difficult for him to just resume the kind of triumphant lifestyle he saw himself having from the outset.
You have a brother, Robbie.
Yeah.
Who's a very talented singer.
Yeah.
Also an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly went through a time of alcoholism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You also write that alcoholism was the Muzak of our familial dysfunction.
Yeah.
So this goes way back.
It goes way back to not to my mother's father, but my grandfather, Bob, who was an entrepreneur, and he's the one who owned the bar. I think one of the reasons he bought the bar was because he could hang out and play music and just part of that culture. And I think it's also his generation, you know, just sort of excused heavy drinking in many ways. And so he was the first person who I heard in the family say, you know, I have a problem with this. My grandmother, she quit very surreptitiously, actually, stopped drinking. I don't remember when it happened. I just know that at one point seeing her very drunk and troubled in a number of ways, and then never seeing her pick up a drink again.
Wow. Cold turkey? No,
it wasn't cold turkey. There's stories, again, you know, there are family stories that I don't have access to at this point, which I probably will at some point. But it was always around in the holidays, and we just, you know, we learned how to absorb into the fabric of our of our family, you know, that these pathologies, this sickness was there.
How serious a drinker were you? Or how serious a problem drinker were you?
I was a blackout drunk. I mean, it was...
Would you drink to get drunk? Or you...
You know what? No, and that was the scary... I didn't think I did. I mean, you know what? Certainly that was what was going on. But I thought I was a social drinker, and I enjoyed... I would go to wine tastings and beer tastings and, you know, the microbrewery stuff and I imagined I was just an Epicurean soul, and this is, you know, these were the things that I pursued. But I couldn't do it without passing out, drinking until I passed out. I put myself and others in great danger far too many times.
Yeah. You describe this, I guess it was an A&E, or maybe it still is, I don't even know, intervention.
Mm-hmm. I think it's still running.
I was Googling all over the Google yesterday to see if I could find some clips, but this was your mom's idea, which was to help your brother. Mm-hmm. You're going to stage an intervention, but for the world to see. For the outside world to
see. So to hear my mother tell the story, and again, you know, one of the difficulties of writing this book was figuring out, was both being a son and the judge of the story, right? And so my mother's perspective was that A&E offered this, the show Intervention offered this free rehab. And all we had to do was suffer the exposure of the show. What I saw and what I continued to see from my writerly perch was someone who very shrewdly got her son back into the public eye via this high-profiled intervention. So he gets rinsed through the process, you know, he gets to come to be cleansed in the ritual intervention of the show, and everyone gets to see it. And what's on the other end of that? Well, we hope the record industry will take him back and everything will be righted.
Mm. Almost out of time. Did that work?
Another question I wrestle with in the book, you know, what do we claim as a win? He's doing what he wants to do. He's living the life he wants to live. And, you know, the exercise for the rest of us is to figure out how to accept and love. Right.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we love to end on the word love. Gregory Pardlow, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Marty. This has been a blast.
Today on Radio Times, a blast for us as well. And again, Gregory Pardlow's new book is called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. And he won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry a couple of years ago for a book of poems called Digest. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder, John Ahrens are the Radio Times producers, with assistance from Alex Stern. If you miss any parts of today's show or past shows, you can always download a podcast of Radio Times through iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.